Time now for Labor Press, your source for daily labor news and industry information. Hear discussions on the workplace and interesting talk from prominent and influential personalities in the labor community. And now your hosts, Neil Tippel and Bill Holfeld.
Accountability.
Hello and welcome to Labor Press's Blue Collar Buzz, the program that tells the story of everyday workers, their struggles, and hopefully their victories. And I'm your host, Bill Holfeld, and in the studio with me is my co-host, Joe Maniscalco. Joe, how were the holidays, buddy?
They were great, Bill, and happy 2018. This is our first show of 2018.
First show of 2018, and it's going to be a good one. And who's our first guest?
We're going to talk to Joe Colangelo. He's president of SEIU Local 246. He's a returning guest, and we're also going to speak to Jordan Ziegler. He's a workers' compensation attorney. And we're also going to speak to Walter Warschecker. He's the training director for the Carpenters Union, and he's going to tell us about everything that's happening over inside the center. But right now, we're going to talk to Joe.
Okay. Well, Joe, welcome back to the program. I remember the last time you're here and you were filling us in on what was going on with new vehicles being purchased for the sanitation department. I take it you have an update on that story.
Yeah, sure. And happy new year to everybody. And when we last spoke, we talked about the problem for my members was that the sanitation department increased their snow fleet by 87%. That's in the hundreds of vehicles. So by doubling the size of the snow fleet, it created a huge problem for the sanitation department, because every year part of the process in the off-season for snow is that the vehicles are prepared and preventive maintenance is done. Vehicles are taken apart, tires, drums, the works. People wouldn't understand that. That's so that when, like we had this past weekend, when the temperatures drop to 5 degrees, 6 degrees, you sometimes just have to send out salt trucks just so that the roads won't freeze.
And Joe, let's remind everybody that your folks in your union are the people that work on all these heavy pieces of equipment.
Correct. My members, I represent over 1,550 tradespeople, almost 1,000 auto mechanics that service every piece of equipment in the city of New York. Police department, fire department, sanitation department, department of parks, bathroom transportation, you name it, we fix it. 26,000 pieces of equipment, one of the largest non-military motor fleets in the world.
All right, going to stop you right there. So I did the math real quick in my head. So there's 26,000 vehicles and 1,000 people. That means everybody's responsible on average for 26 vehicles. That's a lot of vehicles to maintain.
26, more than that. 260.
Wow. Because I can't keep up. I got two in my garage. I can't keep up with that.
Well, that in essence is where the problem is. And there's been a lack of increased funding to hire more mechanics. The equipment has now become very sophisticated, and because of that sophistication, there's a need to train mechanics on a regular basis. So think about it. You have a room of five people, and every day, once a week, you're sending one of them out for training. So really, you don't have five people. You have four. So now you have to take in that consideration. And then with all the other things, like any operation, you have to allow for people on vacation, people that are out injured. So, you know, there's what, like anything else, it becomes a hill that needs to be climbed, right? So then add to that not only the shortage of manpower, the increase in the fleet size, and in addition to the increase in the fleet size, they do another thing that's very interesting, and it may not sound like a whole lot. They'll do is they'll increase the life cycle of a piece of equipment. What does that mean, right? I'm talking technical terms, but to the layperson, you have a car, and your car, you keep your car on average every 10 years, and every 10 years you buy a new car. Well, if I said to you, let's keep that car 11 years instead of 10 years, it doesn't sound like a whole heck of a lot, right? It's just one more year. But when you talk about trucks or, you know, fire equipment or Department of Parks equipment, the dump trucks that you see going around, and you increase that life cycle by just that 1 year, there is on paper savings. The last report I got was about $100 million for when they increase it by 1 year. But what you also do is now you have an older piece of equipment. And because that equipment is older, it needs more maintenance. It needs, you know, it starts to break down. So they did this little maneuver on paper where they increased the life cycle and they increased it from 7 to 8. Really, technicality is that it goes to the last year of the 8 years. So it's like 9 years. I mean, you know, when you have a sanitation truck that's picking up refuse every day and that system is working, you know, sometimes 24 hours a day, they do 2-3 shifts, especially in the wintertime. They have what's called night plow. So they pick up garbage on a 4 to 12 shifts just so they have the manpower in case of a snowstorm.
So, Joe, if you had a magic wand, tell us right now, what would be the right number for a life cycle?
The right number for the life cycle, listen, 7 years, I'm with the city 36 years. I know I don't look that. I look much younger.
No, you look much better than that, Joe.
But the reality is that is, in essence, where you have this problem. You went from a 7-year life cycle to an 8-year life cycle, but you also have the sophistication of the equipment. You know, all the equipment nowadays is computer-generated. There's a lot of systems on that truck that you can't fix. You need a laptop. You need a laptop just to go in there, just to check and see what's wrong with the equipment. So that takes time. And they've done a few other things, like I said, the preventive maintenance cycle, the sophistication of equipment. What would be the right number for manpower? There's a study out there that was done many, many years ago. It's called the Phoenix number. It really comes out of the University of Phoenix. And it was done back in the 1970s. And that's the 1970s, mind you. And what they did in the 1970s is they took fleet sizes and they said for 40 vehicles, you need one mechanic, right, for cars. And they said for a bus, for every 15 buses, you need one mechanic. And for heavy equipment, it's about the same ratio. It's like 12, you know, heavy equipment, you need one mechanic, right? It's called the Phoenix study. And that's really used like a guide for running fleets, is you use that number. If we were to take that number and overlay it on top of the amount of equipment that the city now has and the amount of personnel that you have actually fixing equipment, we would be way off that number. You know, you look at, I'll give you another example, like in the police department, you may say, okay, 40 vehicles, one mechanic, but a patrol car is not like your average car. You look at a patrol car, between the bulletproof glass on the side of the vehicle, the amount of stuff that they have to carry in the trunk, the computer system that's mounted inside the vehicle. They use the patrol car. They use that car like a tool. They drive over and, you know, listen, that's what they have to do, right? They drive over the mediums. They make turns on the highway. They chase people in the street. They're running over curbs. I mean, that's what it's done. So the damage alone to the vehicles, a cop car.
How many miles, a cruiser, how many miles on average do they put on a year?
All right. I'm going to go back about 15 years ago, and it sounds, it'll sound kind of odd, but it's a reality. When they used to buy new patrol cars, they used to send them to Staten Island. And in a year, before the year was up, they would pull them out of Staten Island. Why? Because they almost reached the mileage for warranty. They were doing on average, and my numbers might be off, but they were doing on average like 30, 40,000 miles in a year. Somewhere almost 60,000, because you got to remember, I have the car in the 8 to 4 shift. He has the car in the 4 to 12 shift. You'd have the car in the 12 to 8 shift. So now you're talking about, you know, they literally, and then you wouldn't think Staten Island would be the problem, but because Staten Island, because of the roads and the highways, the highway patrol cars, I mean, they're constantly turning them over, but
all right,
have to.
So it's a safe estimate to say that if you take a city vehicle like that, you're putting on three times as many miles as a normal vehicle.
Sure.
All right. And so that would mean, in layman's terms, and I know absolutely nothing, okay, full disclosure, I know nothing about auto mechanics, except I should change the oil all the time.
There you go.
And I have somebody else do that.
Yeah.
The maintenance should be three times as much.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
That's
okay.
Exactly right.
So,
yeah.
Joe, what is this doing to the workforce, all these
pressures? Straining the workforce. I mean, they've increased the overtime to a point where, you know, they've gone – out-of-service rates have climbed significantly in certain agencies. And what they've done is they've had to bring in personnel on the weekends just to repair equipment. Not that equipment was going out, just to repair equipment. So there's a lot of agencies that have increased the overtime during the week – You know, there's a lot of agencies that have increased overtime on the weekends, had more people working. So it's starting to really weigh on the workforce. And, you know, it's like the double-edged sword. You know, it's good in one way that your members are earning money. But in another way, you know, and listen, this is only the second time it happened. We had, you know, and listen, cops and firemen, I understand they used to work in the holidays. You know, for my members, we had guys that had to come in on Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, New Year's Eve, New Year's Day. It doesn't happen that often, but, you know, it does happen. But, all of these things are starting to weigh on my membership.
And it's a tremendous responsibility
stretching
to keep the city moving.
Yeah, and now, Joe.
That's our logo. We keep New York City rolling.
There you go. Now, we only had about a minute left, so just make believe for a second. I'm Bill de Blasio. I'm sitting here. You got me. You got my 100% full attention. Tell me what you want to tell me.
Well, I think they should increase I think they should review that Phoenix number. They should update that, and they should increase the personnel, and that adjustment should be made on an agency-by-agency, case-by-case basis. And in the way that it's been done in the past, it needs to be really looked back again, and somebody needs to take a hard look at this, because even in, one agency, and I won't give them by name, but one agency alone, I've talked with a bunch of directors, and their headcount, and there's an agency that only has about 150 people. Their headcount is down about 75. They should be at about 2.25.
All right. Well, Joe, you had the mayor's ear, at least for a second, at least in my world anyway. So thank you so much for coming on. Thank you and all your people for keeping New York City moving the way you do. We appreciate you being here.
And thanks so much for giving me the opportunity to speak behalf of my members. Thanks
so
much.
Our pleasure. And we will be back in just a minute with more good talk right here on Labor Press's Blue Collar Buzz at AM 970, The Answer.
You're listening to Labor Press on AM 970, The Answer. You have labor questions? They have answers. Labor Press.
And we're back with more good talk right here on Labor Press's Blue Collar Buzz. I'm your host, Bill Hofeld. In the studio with me is my co-host, Joe Maniscalco. Well, Joe, you know, that's the second time Joe's been on, and, you know, the story is the same, right? The city's not really listening. You got to have people. You can get too much of a good thing. I mean, overtime is nice. I remember overtime, but you can get too much of a good thing. You can't be there 24/7 and keep up the same level of productivity.
Yeah, and in this iceberg, this deep freeze that we're living in has got to compound the challenges that that workforce has to deal with.
Let's hope somebody out there was listening, somebody who can do something about
well,
it.
Well, I know personally that Bill de Blasio tunes in every Sunday night to Blue Collar Buzz.
And I think he follows us on Facebook and Twitter, too, doesn't he?
And speaking of Twitter, I want to remind everybody, if you like us, follow us on Twitter at Labor Press NY. And I just want to let you know, Bill, let everybody else know, we'll close in on 5,000 followers, which is pretty a big deal for us.
And that's more than our families, right?
That's more than our families.
In the beginning,
right?
All we had was our families. Exactly. But anyway, so who we got next?
Right now, we're going to talk about workers' comp. There's tremendous change to the workers' comp system. And we have ace attorney Jordan Ziegler here to talk about some of those things.
Okay. Well, Jordan, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Bill.
Now, you heard Joe, the way he introduced you, you're an ace attorney, so now you got to dazzle us with your brilliance,
now
right?
You got to prove it.
tell us about these changes that he's talking about.
Okay. So in general, by the way, thanks for having me on your inaugural 2018 show. So I've been an attorney for about 25 years in workers' comp for about 19 of those years. And in New York State, workers' comp law has changed several times and many times since it was first enacted. But most recently, the changes began this past year in 2017 when the governor put into the budget a plan to change and reduce benefits based on advances in medical technology and medical treatment. So but the basic sense was, we've advanced medical technology. We've been able to heal arms better than we used to be able to heal arms. So an arm, the value of an arm in workers' compensation should be worth less now than it used to be.
Well, excuse me. I just want to jump in there for a second, because as somebody who had their arm really badly mangled on the job many years ago, I don't care how well you healed me. The time I was out of work, I was still very broke. So right. I'm not really getting the reasoning here.
Well, let's go back to the reasoning. So I'll give you I'll give you the most recent changes. So passed in 2007, St. Patrick's Day 2007, there was a compromise made because New York State at that time had the lowest workers' compensation rate of all 50 states. It was, and when I say compensation rate, workers' compensation means we're going to compensate an injured worker for their injury, and we'll either pay you money while you're losing time from work, or we'll compensate you for the value of your shoulder because you've lost the use of part of your shoulder. So back then, since we were only all earning $400 a week in workers' compensation, the maximum rate, you'd get workers' comp for life if you hurt your back or your neck, your internal parts. So a compromise was made in 07, where now New York State, the comp rate would be indexed with what workers were making in general. It's the state average weekly wages. So every year now, every June 1st, the workers' comp rate increases. So it's been increasing. The value of an arm has been increasing every year since 2007. So in 2007, your arm, Bill, you know, it was worth $400 a week. Today, if you hurt the same arm, same injury, it's worth $870 a week. So insurance people who are paying that money, insurance companies and business counsel, people who want to keep rates low, that's the alleged reason to keep rates lower for workers' comp insurance. And the insurance companies saw an increase in what they were paying out to injured workers, and they wanted to take that back.
Joe, this is shocking. These are headlines. Insurance companies don't want to pay.
I can't believe it.
Isn't it they broke down the guidelines to what actually constitutes an injury as far as like range of motion?
Right.
Like if I could raise my arm above my ear, I'm not really injured.
Right. So what they did was with the new guidelines, well, the first version that came out from the Workers' Comp Board in response to the governor's mandate from the budget saying, let's redo the value, let's redo the guidelines for medical advancements. Their first shot at this a few months ago, they came out and it said basically instead of full range of motion being able to put your hand straight up over your head, full range of motion was now like horizontal, 90 degrees. That's acceptable full range of motion.
That's all you need, Bill.
Oh, is that all you need?
That's all you need.
So in other words, I only have to do half of what I used to be able to do and
right.
I'll still be okay.
Right.
Okay, all right. So, yeah, that makes sense.
And what they did with that, when you talk about money and compensation to the injured worker, they pretty much guidelines suggestion reduced the value of an arm about 90 to 97% of what it was before. That was their first guideline draft. So then, with the all the lawyers got it because lawyers we got the guidelines. Actually, it came out Friday night of Labor Day weekend. That's when we got the guidelines.
That's kind of adding insult to injury, isn't it? Labor Day weekend?
Right, Labor Day weekend to become effective January 1st.
Okay.
So not much time to read it, understand it, and mobilize a response to it. So that's what we did, though. And we sent out with all lawyer groups, sent the guidelines with explanations to all labor groups, whether it was NICOSH and directly to the labor unions, Local 246, the Carpenters Union, Plumbers Union, everybody got directly information about what the new prospective guidelines were. And of course, there was outrage, which is what we expected.
Yeah, and a warning, don't get hurt.
Don't get hurt.
Right. You can't afford it.
You can't afford it. So in response to that, the unions pushed back and said, we don't like this and we don't like that. And all the groups pushed back. And the comp board came out with another set of guidelines, proposed guidelines, which now have become effective as of January 1st. And these were much, much, much less harsh.
So do we get to raise our arms above our heads?
We get to raise our arms. Just don't have a total shoulder replacement because that's worth less than it used to be. But the regular, I call them, my industry, run-of-the-mill injuries of rotator cuff tears and torn meniscus and fractured fingers, fractured arms, those are pretty much have been left intact pretty much. And without getting into the specifics, we're not where we were with the first set of guidelines. So it's a reasonable result.
Well, at the risk of sounding cynical, has anybody looked into how much money came from the insurance companies into the Cuomo campaign?
I'm sure, and I don't have that answer.
I just you don't have a template on that.
I don't have that. I don't have that.
Well, Jordan, Bill just mentioned being hurt on the job as an iron worker all those years. What do people need to know right now if they get hurt?
Okay, so this is the fun part of my job. I have two basic practical things that I do for a living. I represent workers at court and at hearings, and civil service workers and non-civil service workers. It's anybody who is injured who works in New York State. And the other part of my job is I get to educate and teach people one of the best-kept secrets of New York, what happens if you get hurt at work. So I went through 3 years of legal training, 3 years of law school, about 5 to 6 years of federal and state jury trials as a trained lawyer. And if I would have gotten hurt walking up the courthouse stairs, I would have no idea what my rights were for workers' compensation. Why? They don't teach it in law school. And employers don't teach and train their workers what to do if they get hurt at work.
So why is this the best-kept secret in the world?
Because there are so many benefits that attach to workers' compensation that you need to know it. So, for example, there's two ways to get hurt at work. There's accidents and there's illnesses. So an accident, you know it when you see it. If you get hurt at work and you know how, when, where, why something happened, I lifted something, something fell on my head, I tripped, I fell, I walked into a wall, you just had an accident. If you do something over and over and over and over repetitively, and your body wears and tears, just like the city of New York trucks and equipment, the longer you use them and the further they go out, further things start to break down, your body starts to break down. Even if you didn't have an event that you could pick on, but if you're a carpenter, you could be sawing, you're constantly inhaling, you're constantly breathing in bad fumes and dust. If you're an auto mechanic, you're constantly lifting, bending, twisting, carrying, pushing, same, you know, in almost all these labor industries. You're doing the same repetitive work all the time. So you start to see wear and tear at body parts and joints. So you can have a rotator cuff tear from lifting a bench as easily as you can have rotator cuff tear from working for 20 years in these industries.
So if you are hurt and you know you're in trouble, what do? What's the first thing?
So the first thing you do is you notify your employer. Well, actually, let me back up. The first thing you do is you go to a doctor. So if you are hurt and you are in pain, whether it's because you woke up one day with a sore neck or stiff arm, or you fell down on a job site, you'd seek medical care. Nothing I can do as a lawyer I can do without a doctor saying that your injury is work-related. Nope. So it all starts with the doctor.
Well, Jordan, before we run out of time, let the people out there know if they need, because you obviously have an awful lot of information and the rest of us don't have it. So if they need that information and they want to contact you to get that information from you, how and where can they do that?
Okay. Well, the name of the law firm is Pasternak, Tilker, Ziegler, Wolf, Stanton, and Romano. Our website is workerslaw.com. The 800 number is 800-692-3717. We have somewhere between 15 to 18 offices at this point, from Albany out through Southampton. So, and everywhere in between, in every borough, we have offices and live people at every office. So you can touch us that way through the phone, through email, through our website. My email is jziegler, Z-I-E-G-L-E-R, at workerslaw.com. And you can contact me that way.
And just real briefly, Jordan, people get very intimidated sometimes when they have to talk to law offices and they have to talk to professional offices. I'm assuming that you have a friendly way and that people can feel comfortable when they call.
Hopefully. Hopefully it's we've been representing labor for decades. The firm has been around for over 90 years, and the majority of our representation is labor unions, blue collar workers. So we've been doing that for a long time for that reason, that we know how to work with workers.
Well, it sounds good to me. Jordan, thank you so much for coming on the program today. It was a pleasure to talk to you. And we will be back in just a few seconds with more good talk right here on Labor Press's Blue Collar Buzz at AM 970, The Answer.
You're listening to Labor Press on AM 970, The Answer. We return now to Labor Press with your hosts, Neil Tappell and Bill Holfeld.
Together we stand.
And we're back with more good talk right here on Labor Press's Blue Collar Buzz. I'm your host, Bill Holmfeld. In the studio with me is my partner, Joe Maniscalco. Joe, it's amazing that the insurance companies have as much clout as they do to be able to have that much effect on elected officials, especially elected officials that are supposed to be so squarely on the side of labor.
Well, it's not a newsflash. We don't live in a democracy, Bill. If you don't have money, you can't play. And I just want to remind everybody, because we don't do it enough, is like to remind people that if you want to hear more stuff like this, if you want to hear Worker News Daily, to log on to laborpress.org, and you'll see tons of columns and reporting on workers' comp and 1,000 other things that are related to workers.
Because that's what we do, because we know that the mainstream media doesn't, right? That's kind of our mission.
That is exactly our mission.
There you go. So who's up next with us?
Right now we're going to welcome Carpenters Union Training Director Walter Warshecker. And he's going to talk about what's happening at the training center and maybe give us a clue on when the next test is going to be.
Walter, welcome to the program.
Happy New Year, everybody. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, nice to see you. Well, you know, we were talking before the program. You come from a long line pedigree here. I knew your predecessor, and I knew your predecessor's predecessor. All good people over there at the Carpenters Union Hall.
Yep, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's okay. And tell us about the day-to-day operation over there at the training center and how many people you have and just how involved their training program is.
Okay. Well, when we were talking about before with the previous director, Marty Daly, it's come a long way. When I was an apprentice in 1983, we went two nights a week and you went 4 hours a night. Right now we have a full-time program. Apprentices come five times a year, 1 week at a time. And right now we have 1,400 apprentices. We have about, we're about 17% female and about 67% minority. And they get trained, they come Monday through Friday, and it's a four-year program. So they'll be with us from September to June. They'll come from a Monday through Friday, and then they'll go back out into the field to work for about 6 to 8 weeks with a contractor, and then come back to us with training. So
now explain, Walter, because there's a reason why that kind of immersion training is as important as it is in the building trades, and talk about that a little bit.
Right. So what we want is our apprentices, they're going to come, obviously they're going to learn more in the field, but what they're going to learn in a classroom setting, it's a controlled environment. They could, you know, we don't want to say make mistakes, but they could do things over once or twice to learn the trade. Out in the field, they might not have that time frame. The foreman has a schedule that he or she has to meet, so they might not get the attention that they can get in the school. You know, but what we preach in the school, and you know, like Jordan was saying, it's big on safety now. You know, back when I was an apprentice in the 80s, unfortunately, safety was brought up after somebody got hurt. You know, somebody got hurt, and did they threw a hard hat in front of you? Did you do the right thing? Were you using this? Right now, before any of our apprentices go out in the field, they get a week of training. So they'll get OSHA 10, they'll get 4-hour scaffold. They'll be able to go out there and work safely. So not only do we want to teach them a trade and a skill that nobody will ever be able to take away from them, but we want to let them be able to do that for 20, 30 years. You know, we want somebody that's going to do this for a long time and make a career out of this and be able to work safely and go home every night to their family.
And now I know you were an instructor for many years before you had this position, as was I. And one of the things about the immersion training is when you get them in, the apprentices, at night, they're tired. People have no idea how hard they work all day, and you just can't take in as much information when you are that tired. So that immersion training for coming in for a week, that's the other part of it that makes it so positive.
It's everything like that. You're 100% right, because if you think of it, you're coming to school for two nights. If you went on a Monday and a Tuesday, you had to break that down on Tuesday. So you're really not getting that full hours. You're preparing it for the next class. When we get an apprentice from Monday through Friday, that apprentice is, you know, fresh, like you said, 8 o'clock in the morning. They're from 8 to 3:20, and they're learning. They're building projects, and every day when they come in, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, they're building on that project. So they're not just putting something up and taking it down; they're building on it, and then they're taking it down on Friday.
Bill, I had the opportunity a few times to go into the training center, and it's just amazing when you go down and you see all the different types, different variety of work actually going on and training going on, and a lot of different disciplines. Walter, can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, we're really proud of our training center. We actually have six different trades. So when somebody comes in, they're going to decide, people think of carpenters, but they're going to decide if they're going to be a millwright, floor cover, or any one of our specialty trades. And whichever one they choose, they're going to get 4 years dedicated to that. So if an individual comes in and tells us, you know, I'm interested in floor covering, hopefully that person did some research on it, they know what it's about, and we're going to train them for just floor covering for 4 years. Same thing with the other specialty trades, millwright, dock builder, timberman, cabinet. And we have a new one now. The district council recently formed a new 212 high-rise local. So when they did that, we had to construct an apprenticeship program. So those apprentices will come in and they'll learn just high-rise concrete construction.
You know, so the way you have it set up, it's just like picking a major when you go to college, frankly.
Exactly. And that's exactly right. We want somebody to come to us and tell us what they want to do. We don't want them to come to the door and say, well, I think I'll pick that. Or, you know, it may work out for you, but it works out much better when somebody comes in and says, you know what, I researched high-rise concrete. I like that trade. I like working outdoors. I'm not afraid of heights. I like the fast-paced nature of it. That's what I want to do. And they tell us what they want to do, and we put them in that.
Now, Joe, one of those statistics that Walter gave was 17% female. I think that's a number that would shock a lot of people to find that there was a building trade with that high a percentage of females enrolled in an apprenticeship program.
And Walter, that's an increasing number. That's a trend.
Oh, it absolutely is. Again, going back to 83 when I was an apprentice, you just didn't see it, you know, and now you do. And we work closely with NEW, Non-Traditional Employment for Women. They're one of our direct entry programs, which means that the individual doesn't have to wait in line for our lottery system when we pull names. And I think that's what you're asking, which is the million-dollar question. We all want to know that. Hopefully, we're looking to do one in the spring.
Because readers of Labor Press know that when slots do open up, the line around 395 Hudson Street, where the training center is around the block.
Right.
And I remember the last time you guys did it, it must have been like 101 degrees, and people were camping out there, with tents and barbecues.
Yeah, it was a tough week in August. But it just goes to show you how bad people want just a chance to get into the middle class. You know, just a chance to learn the trade, learn the skill, get health benefits, provide for their family, be able to retire with dignity, you know. You know, what we've done in the last couple of years is we only take 250 names at a time because we feel that hopefully we can go through that within a year to 15 months rather than take a bunch of names in and have that individual wait for 3 or 4 years, you know. So it's kind of tricky to actually figure out, all right, because you're basically rolling the dice on the economy. Is it going to be busy 6 months from now, 8 months from now? But we do our best, and we try to do a yearly recruitment. So.
And when you're recruiting, when you talked about direct entry for NEW, I'm sure you also work with Helmets to Hard Hats.
We do. We have a few other direct entry programs. Helmets to Hard Hats is a great one. We have our own one in our building works. We also use Construction Skills, Edward J. Malloy Construction Skills, and we also use Job Corps. So when we do a recruitment, let's just say we're going to take 100 people in, we'll take a certain percentage from our direct entry, which means they've completed a pre-apprentice training program. They've proved to the pre-apprentice instructors and directors that these people they have the desire, they want to do this, and they refer them to us. Once they come into our program, then they follow our rules.
It's really remarkable, Bill, that the amount of people, different, diverse kind of people that come from different disciplines, different occupations, you know, at some point in their life, they're saying, you know, this is not working out for me. I need to change directions. And they go to the carpenter.
Oh, I know. You know, in my own local, when I taught, I would sometimes have apprentices that were 35, 38, 40 years old that had been in other, right after the economic crash, I had people that had been working down on Wall Street. And at age 40, they decided, you know, I want to be in the building trade because of all the things you talked about, because our, you know, health benefits. And
well, our average age is 28. That's the average age of an apprentice. And again, going back when we were younger, 17, 18, that's the people you're on a job with. And what we find now is they've come and they've gone the college route because they were told that's what they have to do. And there's nothing wrong with college, but it's certainly not for everyone. So people go to college route. They spend, you know, sometimes 4 years, accumulate a ton of debt. And now they come to us where they'll actually, which you could talk about some of it, but they'll actually get 47 college credits when they leave our program. Doesn't cost them a dime. They'll learn a trade, they'll learn a skill, and it doesn't cost them anything. Where you go to college, you're bouncing around, not picking your major, you're 40, 80, 60, you know, $100,000 in debt, and then you find a career that you might not even like to do, if you could even find work in that career, you know?
And there are just some people who just really like doing what they do. I mean, the building trades, as we know, building trades is a very interesting and unique way to spend your life.
Well, it's tangible. You know, at the end of the day, you saw what you did. You saw that wall you framed, and I'm sure that's why we got into it. I know that's why I did, because I just, you know, school was all right, but I didn't want to be in school the rest of my life.
So, Walter, in the last minute that we have, you know, in addition to tuning into the show and logging on to laborpress.org every day, how do people find out when slots are actually opening up?
Well, what we do is we put on our website New York City District Councilor Carpenter's Training Center. We also list it on the New York City District Councilor Carpenter website. We'll announce it at meetings. We'll post it in a major publication, usually a couple months before, you know. So, again, we just pulled some names in, so we want to see these apprentices go out to work, make sure they're working, then we'll do another recruitment. That's why we're hoping for this spring sometime, March or April.
That'd be great, and I'm sure a lot of people will be lining up at your door again in March and April for that opportunity. Well, thank you so much for all the work you're doing. Especially that, as you mentioned earlier, that safety component, right? Because we don't want them to just make a living. We want them to make a living and come home in the same condition every day. So, Walter, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And we will be right back with more good talk in just a second, right here at AM 970 The Answer.
You're listening to Labor Press on AM 970 The Answer. Welcome back to Labor Press, the show about labor and the laborer. Here are your hosts, Neil Tappell and Bill Holfeld.
And we're back with more good talk right here on Labor Press's Blue Collar Buzz. I'm your host, Bill Holfeld. In the studio with me is my partner, Joe Maniscalco. And Joe, we got a special treat now because we managed to corral everybody that's been on the program today. And I'm going to start this out. I'm going to give everybody an opportunity. We've got all walks of life. We've got an attorney. We've got somebody from the public sector and somebody from the private sector. Okay, but all within the world of labor. And I'm going to throw out.
Why don't we have everybody just introduce themselves again?
We will in just a second. I'm going to throw out a question first.
Okay.
And I want everybody to respond to it in a way. What do you want to see for labor? What do you want to see for labor happen in 2018 and why? And we will start on the end here with Jordan. Jordan, introduce yourself again, Jordan.
Jordan Ziegler. I'm a partner in the law firm of Pasternak, Tilker, Ziegler, Walsh, Stanton, and Romano. And we represent injured workers for workers' compensation.
And what do you want to see happen, Jordan, in the wonderful world of labor and why?
For my theme as the lawyer in the room is basically we see our law firm as a safety net for injured workers. So I guess what I would want to see is continued education to labor unions to further educate their membership on what to do if they get injured at work and what their rights are and what their benefits are and what they're giving up if they don't do that.
Are they doing a good job right now?
They're doing a pretty good job. I mean, I know Joe very well in the room and Walter very well in the room, and I go into whether it's an apprentice training, a shop steward certification course, or a general union membership meeting, and some of these things I speak, the shop stewards at the carpenters, I'll talk for over an hour and a half, and we'll have a conversation on injured workers because they've been around for a while, so they know what to expect and what's going on. With the apprentices, last week I was at the apprentices, and I got them on their first day of apprentice school, day one, so I didn't want to try to scare them out of becoming a millwright or a dock builder or a carpenter.
Don't go out there, you'll get hurt.
That was about a 10-minute talk. When I go to Joe's guys and we do a general union meeting, maybe 15 minutes, but it's always the same theme. If you get hurt at work, seek medical care. After you seek medical care, there are benefits and there's rules and there's things you have to file with the Workers' Compensation Board to get the benefits you deserve. And your employer is not always the one who will give you the best information on what to do. So firms like myself, private practice firms, we watch out for the injured workers and we watch their back. So they're doing a pretty good job on education. To me, you can always do more.
Okay. Well, Jonah, I'm a lot more familiar with the building trades than I am with, auto maintenance. So tell us, what are some of the real dangers of people getting hurt in your sector?
Oh, listen, we have the union. Again, I'm Joe Colangelo, Local 246, president, SEIU 246 in New York City. We have a scholarship fund, Lawrence Kamenick. Lawrence Kamenick was an auto mechanic. That was working for the police department back in 1985-ish, and he got killed in the line of duty. He was crushed underneath the while servicing a truck. He was by himself, and we have a scholarship in his name. I mean, it's a dangerous profession in a sense. Thank God, it doesn't happen all too often. But you know, when you're working around heavy equipment, you know, like I said, with the city of New York, the amount of equipment that we have, it could be a dangerous proposition. You got to be very careful. You have to be skilled in what you're doing. Like with the carpenters, what required for the city of New York is you have to be a journeyman. 5 years experience before you qualify when you take an exam for auto mechanic. So there are different entry levels. It's called a service worker title, somebody coming out of high school, 1 year experience, and then they could put 3 years in, and that will qualify them for the 5 years experience. But you need that experience. The exams that the city gives, and there's one coming out within this year. We only have, you'll have maybe, when I took the job, you had 1,500 people take the exam. You're lucky if you got 15-20% pass rate. And even today, the pass rate is like that, 15%. So, you know, you'll have, I think the last exam we had 785 people sit for the exam. You got a list of maybe 163 names.
So, Joe, so let's say I'm a high school senior right now, okay? I'm going to be graduating this coming June. And I think, wow, I really love auto mechanics. I'd love to work for the city, work on all those different vehicles. What would be my best bet?
Well, if you were entering high school, I would recommend that you go to a trade school, because if you go to a trade school, that would qualify you for the 1 year experience for the title of service worker. So if you're coming out of a general high school, you don't qualify. But if you're coming out of like Grady High School, Automotive High School, Aviation High School is where I graduated. If you're coming out of one Edison High School, if you're coming out of one of those trade schools, those 4 years that you were in school qualifies you for 2 years of experience.
Okay, but let's take the kid. Let's say he's in his senior year and all of a sudden he's faced with this and he realizes, you know what, Mom, Dad, I don't want to go to college. What I really like is cars, but he doesn't have that trade school background. What does that kid do?
Well, he could, you know, they have Lincoln Tech is a trade school that's out there. A lot of the dealerships, you know, right and nowadays, it's very hard to recruit mechanics. The trade itself is not like when I was a kid. So because of that, there are some programs out there, dealership programs, where they can get their foot in the door and learn about the trade and learn about the, you know, like we say, the theory more than anything else. It's not a matter of turning wrenches. You need to know the theory behind what makes that vehicle work. You know, the engine, the transmission, the braking system, the electronics, the computerized system, all of those things nowadays. Before, you know, growing up as a kid, you stepped on a brake pedal and the brakes applied. Nowadays, it's all controlled by electronics. You know, braking systems, even on the heavy-duty equipment, is all electronic, all computerized. So even every single system on a vehicle now is controlled in some way by a computer. So that technology, you know, you need to know all of it. Not only the mechanical, physical part, but you need to know the theory part as well. You know, because that comes into the thinking of how to solve the problem. Like the carpenters, as they mentioned, you know, it's the satisfaction at the end of the day that I took my knowledge and I fixed it and I repaired it on my own. There's some self-gratification in that that is unique to most tradespeople. And I think regardless of the trade or where you work or what industry you work at, all tradespeople have that same sense of accomplishment that I was able to do this, or like a construction worker, my brother was in construction for the 35 years. I worked on that building.
Yep.
You know, you know what I mean? That your blood, sweat, and tears goes into that. And there's a certain pride that comes along with that that can't be taken away from you. And, you know, that's all part of it. Well, it's all part of it.
Walter, let's jump to you for a second here. Now, what do you see to be your biggest challenge in 2018, and what's your strategy for meeting that challenge?
The non-union sector. That's the biggest challenge right now. We have to, you know, our organizing department goes out and does a tremendous job of you know, selling our contractors, our signatory contractors, that we could bring the job in quicker, we could bring it in safer. You know, nothing against the non-union sector, but they need to learn. They should come to us. They need to learn the benefits of working union, the health benefits, the job security, the retirement packages and stuff like that. So what I'd like to see, again, the economy just keep going like it's going, maybe, you know, just it's on an uptick, obviously. Keep that going strong, but more union work so we can prove to the public sector and just prove to everyone how good it is to work union, how, you know, the jobs will come in quicker. The jobs will come in with less injuries on it because we're trained, we're better trained, we're better skilled.
And what would you say to people that say, oh, well, they can't afford to build union? And I know what I would say to them, but what would you say to them?
You can't afford not to. That's basically it. You can't afford not to, because if you want to look, you know, we're going to bring the job in, you know, probably half the amount of time. We're going to do it professionally. We're going to do it safer. Our men and women that come out of the apprentice program are going to be trained. They're going to know all aspects of the safety part. Like we said, you know, the non-union sector, they're not getting training on safety. Even if they know something is wrong, let's say with a piece of scaffold equipment, they don't have the avenues to go to get it corrected. That could turn into a public safety issue. You know, if you're working on a scaffold outside a building or something like that. So if you go union, our men and women, they come out, they know what's right and wrong, and they know how to go about to get it fixed if they do see something right or wrong without fear of losing their job.
And, you know, Joe, you know what I find interesting about this? Here we are. This is Blue Collar Buzz, right? We're here sitting here in Blue Collar Buzz world. And all three of our guests today, their main point for their strategy for 2018 is training and education. You know, and that's not necessarily the jump that most people out there make.
And I'm just thinking about, Walter, in your position as the training director of the Carpenters Union, to see the demand. We talk about the people lining up, you know, around the block, the demand for people wanting to get entree into the middle class. That's got to be a tremendous source of frustration that you can't take more people, because even if we do have, you know, the, you know, building is booming here in New York City, but still the union share is not where it should be. And that should be, Bill, someplace where government, if we had actually, you know, an administration that was dedicated to ending a tale of two cities, I remember somebody saying, we could actually get more union people out there.
Yeah, market share, you know. And again, we have political directors, and we have organizers, and they go out and they try to organize the non-union, just make them aware, because some of them probably aren't even aware. You know, their top people are making maybe $10 an hour, $15 an hour, and God forbid they do get hurt on a job, the contract, I don't even know that person. What are you doing on my job? And we hear stories like that, you know, and it's unfortunate. It shouldn't happen in this city. It shouldn't happen in this country. But to let people know what the union offers, you know, and to remove that stigmatism of the union. You know, it's five people standing there, one person working. It's not reality, you know, but unfortunately that's what a lot of people think of when they think of union. And, you know, and we're doing a lot better job, again, with our organizing department and our political directors of showing the politicians, you know. They come down, they tour our training center all the time, which is great, you know, because they can come down anytime and see our training center, see the men and women we train, see the diversity that's there, and see the type of training they're getting, you know.
Well, Walter, thanks a lot, guys. Thanks a lot for doing this. We got to wrap it up right now. We're going to throw it back over to Bill for a spotlight on American labor history.
Thanks, Joe. On January the 13th, 1874, over 7,000 of New York City's working class crammed into Tompkins Square Park. They came from across the city to meet and march to City Hall to petition for a public works program that would strengthen the infrastructure of the city and provide jobs for the cold and hungry. They hoped city officials would lend a sympathetic ear, so they attended the rally with cautious optimism. Instead, the city fathers revoked the permit for the rally and assigned over 1,600 police to disperse the assembly. No notice of that revocation was ever posted. The result, of course, was a bloodbath. Among those who witnessed the event was Samuel Gompers, who later said, quote, "Mounted police charged the crowd on 8th Street, riding them down and attacking men, women, and children without discrimination. It was an orgy of brutality."
All right, that does it for another episode of Labor Press's Blue Collar Buzz. Just want to remind everybody, if you like us, follow us on Twitter at Labor Press NY. Find us on Facebook. Also, visit our website at laborpress.org. Write to us at bcb@laborpress.org. And tune in next week here on AM 970 for more Blue Collar Buzz at 9 p.m. AM 970, The Answer.